Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we get people from different parts of the world, different cultures and backgrounds to get together and talk about what's happening in the world. But what we're going to be doing today is a little bit different. We're going to do a special on what's happening when you are isolated socially for a long time, and hopefully how to help cope with issues that might crop up. And for those of you who do experience those, it might be helpful, I hope. My name is Patrick Beja, and I'm very glad to be welcoming back to the show Wendy Dunford. How's it going, Wendy?
Good. Hi.
Hey.
Doing okay. I'm in the same boat as everyone, so I don't know. Am I good? I don't know. I'm just going to say it. I'm good.
We don't know anything, so let's assume we're good. So we did an episode about toxic relationships last month, and that was pretty popular. I don't know if I can say popular for a heavy topic like that, but people seem to be interested. So I know this is a little bit of a departure from the usual format of the show. Even when we do specials, it's usually about understanding someone from a different background. And this is about situations. So hopefully it's interesting to you all. If it isn't, please let me know. If you'd rather we didn't delve into these kinds of topics, let me know. And especially if you're supporting the show, because of course, if you're giving your hard-earned money for the show, then if you'd rather have something else, I'm definitely listening. So, and by the way, if you do enjoy the show, please consider giving us your hard-earned money. It's at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is in the show notes, and thank you a million to those who already do. So you're doing well. So I guess I wanted to start with that. How's it going? And how's do you call it confinement in the US? I guess it's more shelter at home.
Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, it's the French term, and I'm kind of translating it a little bit directly.
Got it. Okay.
So it's that shelter at home.
So shelter in place is a term that actually has some more scary connotation than you might think. Of course, it's pretty particular to the United States, which is a term we use when there's an active shooter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we have lingo around what you do when someone is shooting up a neighborhood or a school or, you know, something horrible like that. And shelter in place is one of those terms of like, don't leave your house, because when you leave your house, you're now putting yourself in greater danger. So that's been the term a lot of different states have used. And but the reality is some states have decided that it's because it's not the same thing in some ways. So they've changed the term to stay at home or stay at home or shelter in place. I forgot what the other ones are, but they're basically just like, stay home.
Yeah.
I mean, they're trying to brand it, you know, so you feel a little better about it, you know, but yeah. That's essentially what it is. We've been on that for at least 3 weeks now. Officially, like, really only leave for emergency situations or for necessities. That's been about a week and a half. But we've been home for about a month total with spring break and kids and stuff. So, you know, it's been a while, and I realized the other day my kids have not seen their friends' faces in a month. That's a long time to connect with the people you care about. And my job is online, so I get to see a lot of my people and my face. It's very similar to what I've always done, which So not a huge adjustment that way. However, there's more to this, and we're going to get into all of that.
All right.
It's not as simple as, oh, I work on a computer, so I'm fine. There's, well, there's biology going on.
It's a little bit, I mean, I think for me, I think a lot of our peers have more experience with social isolation than other peer groups, I suppose, yeah. Because we're known for being a little bit antisocial, which is not, you know, it's not like we're hiding in our caves right. forever, but we're used to, if we're on our own, we can entertain ourselves and we have hobbies that don't necessitate to go out and party and go to bars, even though many of us still do. I guess we can manage, I think, a little bit more if we're asked to stay home, because we know a little bit more what to do. But as you said, I'm sure there's biology involved and it doesn't mean we're all fine. But for me, I'm really, it changes very little. And I'm not in a big city. As people know, I live in the middle of the forest in Finland. And of course, there's a little bit of change as well, because I don't go out and to restaurants and stores and stuff like that. But I'm still in the middle of the forest, so I can go out, go for a walk, which I don't because I'm working twice as much as I usually do, strangely. But right. the only difference is the kid is home. So, and even for that, we have four of us at home on top of the child, which means we can split the child caring duties. So I really shouldn't complain. It's still starting to feel like... I wouldn't mind it ended fairly. I wouldn't mind it ending fairly soon. It's been almost 5 weeks for us here in Finland.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, and that's relatively strict. Like we can go out of the house, of course, because it's the forest in front of the house. But we like go shopping once a week, and that's it, almost.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But yeah, and so well, let's get into what it sort of does to us. And I think, you know, I like to think of, you know, your listening audience and even me, even though I'm not kind of in the gaming community necessarily, but so much of my work is online and so much of, I work from home. So I have a lot of training and so do you. And so do your listeners, the training of, you know, used to the same four walls, right? There's some elements of just like, I'm comfortable here and I know where, et cetera, right? So that means you kind of have an advantage on one hand for this. But the thing that no one's prepared for, and some who, you know, their jobs is to travel and work with people face-to-face all over the place or be in large groups all the time. Like for those folks, this is a shock to the system to really, you know, the thing they probably craved all the time was like, oh, I just love to be home and relax. Well, now we were 5 weeks of being home and relaxing. And the key there is that it's not all that relaxing. So what I wanted to talk about
I feel like in the beginning, in the first week or two, it was like everyone was saying, oh, we're going to have so much time, which turned out maybe for people who don't have kids, that might be the case, but not others, which it's especially hard for those who have kids. But Even for other people, I feel like in the past week or two, people have started saying, I'm actually pretty stressed. I might have a little bit more time, but it's not. So there's a very clear change, empirical evidence. But in my experience, people have changed their attitude a little bit. Like it's, yeah, we have to do it, but it's not like, all right, we're going to do that. Try to, you know, yeah.
It's not a vacation anymore, or even in theory, because now we've proven it's not very relaxing.
It never was. And it felt like it might be in some respects, but it's ending up not to really be a vacation for anyone.
Yeah. And you run out of closets to clean after some point. You're like, all right, what else do I do here? I mean, I'll tell you the busiest places. So it's non-essential or essential sort of stores are open, and they have deemed hardware stores essential because buildings still is continuing in sort of a commercial sense, I understand. But it's for people at home to paint their walls, to redo stuff, because they're just staring at them all the time. And, you know, so there is something to be said for, you know, what was going on in your brain before quarantining, which is, you know, I'm going to use that word as the thing we're all doing, we're quarantining, is interesting how that is playing out now. So if you think about the setting, you all go home, right? Everyone has to go to where they live. And we're not going to maybe spend any time on those people because Finland, you don't necessarily have any homeless. We do in the United States quite a bit. So there's a lot of challenges we're facing with the underprivileged and underserved populations in our country, because it's very clear our billionaires can just go onto their yachts, right? And the homeless have to somehow find a place to shelter. And then, you know, a virus spreads in those kinds of circumstances just so easily. So everyone who's working with any kinds of situations like that are just stressed to the max to try to, you know, calm those systems. Also, the prison system is another example of that. Those close quarters, and they're all in lockdown. I mean, it's just, it's a mess. So you've got each sector having its own challenges. A lot of people experiencing this thing where I'm busier than I've ever been in my life, because I have four kids at home in school. I have literally six computers running on full speed all day long, everyone trying to learn. I mean, it's a mess. Plus, both of us, my husband and I, working from home. Plus, we got this dog that is a godsend because it makes us walk and get outside all the time, but also is annoying. And so we have this just like so much chaos, whereas my cute neighbors are just, you know, in their 50s or 60s and their kids are grown and they're just alone. I have nothing to do. And I just want to borrow their boredness. Like, give me an hour of your boredness, right? So we're in such different places. But the thing that's collective and common amongst everyone, and everyone, again, may be dealing with it slightly differently, but is anxiety or fear, right? I mean, we're all doing this because we need to flatten the curve and, you know, help hospitals handle the people coming, and, you know, all of the, there's good big motives for doing it. But then what ends up happening is, you know, you're home, you watch a little too much of the news. In fact, I was going to ask you, what's your, do you do any panic scrolling is what we call it, right? Where you're,
you know, it's funny.
Reading after article.
I was thinking about whether or not I was afraid, because you were saying there's the fear, and I know that many people do experience it, and it seems like there's a little bit more of a hectic feeling in the US from what I'm gathering from here. But in my specific case, I am very much not afraid. And it might be because I don't, you know, I don't have a TV. I don't watch TV. I have a TV that's only connected to the Apple TV, so I don't really watch the news, essentially, is what I'm getting at. I usually browse the news, you know, Google News in the morning when I wake up, and that's about it. And I kind of know what to expect, and I kind of know the way out, which is just stay the F home, and at some point it will subside. And so all that is a long way of saying I'm not really experiencing that fear. And I think it's because I don't watch the news.
Absolutely. Because, and this is, everyone has a different way of feeling control when they feel out of control, right? And I mean, I have to assume that living in the forest in Finland has to feel like a pretty safe bet.
Yeah, I mean, there is the worry of what the hell's going to happen with Russia, which is a very specific worry that Finns and people along the border, the Russian borders, have. But that's more of a, you know, it's more of a midterm issue.
Okay, so take that actually as like, that may be your specific thing. It's kind of a little far out, but you don't really know, and you're, you know. And imagine you gave a lot of attention and energy to it because you were bored, and and you dove deep into that. I mean, you could really scare yourself pretty good. And so everyone has some version of this, right? So maybe it's that you live in Finland and there's Russia, or I recently moved from Sweden and they have all their kids still going to school, and I have this fear for them from far away. Like, you guys, I don't know if that's a good idea, you know? So they have their own concerns. Like, the whole entire world has stopped school but them. And are they being stupid? What, you know? So they have their own issue. In the United States, there's always lots of challenges. Of course, our medical healthcare system is good when you can pay for it. And there are people who are going to have major financial jump. I mean, we also have a leader who, you know, there's a lot of scary stuff that can happen. So you're watching the news and you're taking that in. And what I want to get into a little bit is just what our brain does and what our brain needs. And what our brain does is sometimes to feel control, it tries to get more and more information, right? And so that's why people will often deep dive into the news and almost, I call it panic scrolling, because they can't stop. I don't know, maybe you've done that with Twitter before where you're just like, keep going, and suddenly an hour's gone by and you went, oh, I did not mean to do this for this long.
Yeah.
Now, if you do that with frightening information about a virus that is crazy effective at doing its job, this thing is astounding when you study it in a horrifying way, you can just get more and more freaked out. And it very much is on a very deep level. It isn't simply, oh, that's freaky, or, you know, and maybe the economy is the place that you get really nervous. So you start to sort of really pay attention to what happens economically and the fear of what will happen and et cetera, et cetera. So you may find your angle of how you're handling the lack of control with what you consume. But you're right. And one of the benefits you have found is one of the things I would suggest is that finding some limits within that usage. I think a lot of people maybe are turning to social media more and more for social connection. But that's a mixed bag, right? If you're actually connecting, or if you are just reading your crazy uncle's conspiracy theory about, you know, so like, is that actually helping you, or is it potentially harming you?
So how do you stop doing the thing that is harming you? Because it feels like some kind of addiction sometimes, where even the news, you just keep watching because you feel you need to be informed, when in reality, even if you know it, you know, you're not getting more informed. You're just watching the stuff that you watched 2 hours ago, and it's just repeating and increasing your stress. And it feels like maybe this applies to more than just shelter in place situations, like it's general life. But it's especially problematic now. How do you even stop? Maybe I'm jumping the gun on your...
No. That's a really great question. Well, let me back up just a little with... Let me explain what is happening in your body, so that then we talk about why you need to stop, because your motive to stop doing something is really important, right? Because if it's just like, oh, I should probably not do that, or my friend said that's not good for me, those are not motivating reasons to stop something. But there is a really highly motivated reason if you can tap into it. So let's first talk about what happens to your body. So when you are exposed to something negative, traumatic, scary. I mean, some of the stories coming out about how people are dying alone. You know, we heard a bunch of the stories coming out of Italy with respirators being rationed and, you know, like all of that scary, like you have to decide who's going to die or live because there wasn't enough respirators. You know, we had a bit of like, oh, wow, that's Italy. Well, then it came to New York, and New York is, you know, they're handling it fairly well, but we do not have enough equipment. We don't have enough equipment. We don't have enough in all the places that it needs to be. So that induces a sense of scarcity and panic. And for me, I'm always like, who's in charge of this? You know, it feels like there's a vacuum of leadership generally. And so what it will do is it floods our bodies with stress hormones. So normally we could like look at the news maybe and then go off through our day, and we have interaction with the barista when we get our coffee, or we're talking with somebody at work, or we have a tournament that night we're going to go to, or a game or a concert. We had all these other things that were signs that like, oh, I'm living my life, I'm doing okay. And back then Netflix was simply like, oh, I could rest and relax and watch Netflix. Now Netflix is nothing but a drug, right? Anyway, so that idea is that it was counterbalanced. But what's happening when you're home and you're not going anywhere, and you don't have those human connections, even though they're subtle, right? Even just being near other people, that reduces our stress hormones, because we're tribal creatures. We are, we get our safety cues from those around us. We, you know, like you go to the grocery store and half the shelves are empty. There is a panic alarm that goes off in everyone's brain.
Not illogical, but not thought through. It's like instinctive. Yeah. And if I get what you're saying correctly, when you get the stressful thing that is stressing you out and you think, oh, maybe the world is on fire, And then you go out and you realize the barista is there and your friend is at work, and you realize, you get an opportunity to realize the world isn't actually on fire, then it yes. calms you down. But now yeah. you're staying home. You don't get those outside cues. So you're staying on that level of stress of the world might be on fire. The world actually is on fire. Oh my God. And that right. continues throughout the day.
Right. So there's no, and like you're saying, it's unconscious on so many levels. Now we're in a more conscious state because, I mean, literally everyone on earth is in this thing together. And there is some awareness that's changed a little bit. So let me just briefly talk about what happens with the flooding of these stress hormones, what it does to our body. So one of the stress hormones that gets released when we're stressed is called cortisol. And that builds up and gets dissipated as the stress is gone. And it's built for fight or flight, right? So tiger jumps out at you, you run, you make it safely into the village and the tiger stops and your cortisol then can go down. You can go back to a homeostatic state. You are safe. And what happens with modern humans is we don't have tigers, but we have the news tigers, right? Or reality tigers or whatever it might be. And for a lot of people, there's conflict in their own homes that they've been able to maybe not hyper-focus on because they could leave or I got to go to work or the kids are at school. And now you are face to face with some of those tigers in your private personal family life. And so that fight or flight cortisol situation is just on high release all the time. And what happens long-term, and anyone who's ever hit the wall, burned out, they'll know what I'm talking about. You maintain these level of high stress hormones for a period of time. And then your body doesn't have it gives you alarm bells, but most people ignore those. Usually it's you stop sleeping as well, or, you know, your eye starts twitching, right? Like we have a couple things that say, hey, this isn't good. And then it has a shut off and it is your endocrine system just gives up and says, okay, you're now done. And you are exhausted, depressed. There's all sorts of ramifications from pushing yourself past that. And that's where we get into a little trouble with this home shelter home situation is there isn't really respite necessarily anywhere that is going to come for us. We have to create it, which is what my goal today is, to give everyone some things they can actually do at home to increase their sense of well-being, reduce this cortisol flooding. And you've hit on my favorite one, which is to really, really reduce the news that you intake or the scary story limit, right? Because we're humans. We love to hear a scary story. We love to hear it. We like, you know, but it should be once a summer at a camp.
You know, it's funny because, I don't watch the scary stories, but the news tigers, the reality tigers. But when you're talking about the effects, because maybe that's me, just me, but when you're talking about, you know, high stress levels, I feel like I get in my head the image of someone being like physically like tense and twitchy all the time. And I'm like, oh, that's not me. I'm not, you know, I'm fine. And then you talk about, you know, maybe you sleep a little bit less well and you have like your eye is twitchy, as you said, stuff like that. And I realize I think I've talked about it a little bit on the show. As much as I love my kid, I don't think I was built to be a parent. So I never quite know if I'm doing the right thing. And it's a little bit more stressful for me to try to interact with my son, I think, than maybe other people who are more naturally gifted for these things. And so that stress for me is a little bit higher. And now since it's constant, I'm realizing that maybe I fit at least partly in that description that you're giving, because it's, you know, I am always on because I'm either working or taking care of the kid or sleeping. Like literally, I don't have any other time to wind down. So I think it might apply to more people than we would have the image of for people who are stressed. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that always being on thing is, and this is what parents are experiencing worldwide, because before we had a built-in daycare, or we had a built-in, even if it was just a babysitter that could come over for a couple hours, or you know, we could go out and get a break. This is full on. It's parenting like no one's ever had to do before. I think maybe back when we just lived in little small towns, but then you had grandparents. I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's the first time it's ever been this full on, especially for all of us. And it is exhausting. Absolutely. So let's just talk about what you can do. And we'll take your case in particular, but this absolutely can apply to other people, whatever it might be. And here's one of the things, you know, if there's any workaholics listening, you're going to realize, oh, this strategy I've always used, which is to just work harder to deal with my feelings, maybe is limited. Or if you've lost your job, which is becoming a common thing, for a lot of people, that your job, you know, you're an event planner for this company. Well, that is no longer a thing. It may never come back. We don't know. We have, you know, and so the company lays you off. So you went from hard charging workaholic, I'm not going to deal with other stuff in my life because I got this and this and this. Suddenly you have nothing. That can be a really scary experience to just be, you know, feel all your feelings. And so I think a lot of people, and this is true of humans, we don't love to feel all our feelings all at once. We can't handle it usually. And so we have all sorts of tricks we use to avoid feeling them. And a bunch of our tricks have been taken from us now. So we have what we can do at home. But here's the antithesis to this and the antidote to that, which is super powerful, but also understandable why we don't want to do it. We have no practice at this. So it's something we can practice. And that is to give yourself a mental break. So like, Patrick, you are dad all the time. You are working all the time. So when is it Patrick moment for a break? Do you have any built in anything yet? Or are we going to have to do that today?
I think we might have to do it today, because the thing I would traditionally go to would be playing video games, I suppose. The issue I have, which is a great problem to have, I'm very lucky, but when I play video games now, it's kind of for work. And so even when I try to relax, I start playing a game and I'm like, oh, I have to think about this and I have to, like, I get into work mode immediately. So I don't really have a Patrick time anymore.
Okay. So this is what I want everyone to develop your Patrick time.
Actually, okay. But we might have something to work with. My real Patrick time, and this is deep into personal stuff, people, and it's very intimate, not in the way you think. My personal time is actually lunch, which I stop everything. I go prepare something I really enjoy for food. There's like two dishes and I do one of the two. And I get back into my office. I have a big TV because, you know, work, computer and consoles. And I put on a TV show, a TV series from Netflix or whatever. And I have an hour when I'm just watching that, having food. And like, this is the one thing that I preserve, which makes me really happy. So maybe that's something
that is
to work
it,
with.
Right,
yeah,
there
you go.
And more time than, and here's the thing, that's maybe all you're going to get. So I want to say something about, I want everyone to develop their Patrick lunch hour, whatever that looks like. You have a couple elements that are really important. Well, you're French, so naturally enjoying your food has to be part of it, right? And it is the greatest gift the French have given us, is to just, if we could all copy how you eat, just enjoy the food, right? Because what it is, it's actually, the technical term is mindfulness, that you are mindful of the moment you're in, right? You're really enjoying the food that you're in. You're watching the show and doing nothing else. That one singular activity, now granted you're kind of combining two, but for the most part, a singular activity where you are fully present, even though the show takes you to a different world, that is where Netflix is good medicine, right? Netflix becomes bad medicine when you're avoiding all the other things in your life and you feel worse afterwards. So that's what I want to kind of get to. What makes you feel better and worse? And most people are pretty garbage at tuning into how they feel. But if you stopped after your Patrick lunch, you have 1 hour, you've eaten your food and you've watched your show and you took just 30 seconds and just checked in with your body and how you feel, and you let that really sink in, that hour will do everything you need it to do. What we tend to do though is we put ourselves last on the list. we can't figure out how to find a place to stick that time where we are fully present in that moment. But that is incredibly powerful and will cover most of the rest of your day. And so that's sort of ritualizing. And this leads to this next point, which is really important, is creating a new routine that includes sociality in a different way, but mainly is to bring meaning to your day. So Patrick, because you have worked from home and you kind of already have your rhythm, your work meaningfulness and what you have to accomplish, that probably hasn't changed much. But for most people who have worked outside of their homes and now have to work at home, they're facing a very different thing. It's like the meaningfulness of their work has shifted, and they maybe even don't realize that it has. And especially those who are no longer working or cannot do their work. It's really tricky to find meaning in cleaning out your closet and staring at the wall. Yeah. And so the way to create meaning is to build an artificial schedule. So give me a sense of what your schedule looks like. We're just going to use you as the guinea pig for a second. What does your typical day look like?
Wake up around 6 to 6:30 because I know the kid is going to wake up fairly early after that. Get him to eat and then play for a couple of hours. And then the workday starts. And it's work, 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 work. And with the break, with the Patrick lunch hour, which is so, so important. And then around 5:30, bath time, food time, and either me or my wife puts him to bed, which takes 30 to 45 minutes. And then we have about an hour or two where we can chill again a little bit, the two of us together. And then it's bedtime because the thing starts again. And it's funny because you might think, you know, we go to bed at 10, some usually, and we wake up at 6. That's plenty of time to sleep. But not only does he often wake up a couple of times during the night, but also it for some reason, it's not as restful as it might be, which relates to what you were saying before, as it might be in other times.
So. Yes. And okay, so that's a great schedule. It's a very toddler, young child schedule.
Right.
And I'm sure many people are in that mode. What?
I'm sure many people are in that mode and even more stressed because they don't have as many people at home to help out.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that can feel, in the best of times where there's no pandemic and you can get yourself out of the house whenever you need to, that can still feel very monotonous. And I think that's the new norm for a lot of people has moved into toddler schedule time, in the sense of it's the monotony of doing the same thing, going to bed, waking up, doing the same thing again and again. Oh, now it's the weekend. Okay, well, I guess I'll just stay up a little later. You know, like there's no variety.
The weekend, one thing that I've noticed as well is that the weekend doesn't really feel like a weekend because obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, but even more for me because I'm working a little bit. Even I try to be good about this, but it's like, as I was mentioning, my hobbies are my work. And I also have stuff that crops up when you're, you know, independent. You always have stuff to do. So bottom line, weekends don't really feel even less like weekends. So it's just one continuous series of days where that feeling that you're talking about of, well, I wake up and I do the same thing every day, is a very strong feeling. So I realized that that thing that for 1 or 2 weeks, you're like, yay, that's kind of funny, we're going to be doing stuff. Like after you realize for 3 weeks, I've actually been like, it's been an endless string of days that look exactly the same, one like after the other. That's when it's like, oh, well, it's not that awesome after all.
Great. Right. And this is where discipline maybe has to come in and sort of enforcing an artificial structure to your life can really, really be helpful. You have to distinguish when the weekend starts. So it happened naturally before, right? Work, 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 work. Okay, now there's a farmer's market on a Saturday. That's different. Or we always go to a movie Saturday, Friday night or whatever. You know, so it used to just kind of occur. And then you would throw in some work to get some extra, you know, a step up on the next week or something. And now there is this reality that you have to draw lines in your life to create some differences, which ultimately make things meaningful, right? It's almost like with no boundaries, everything's the same. And so normally we would have wished, oh, I would love to do this or that because it would sound like a break from the norm. And now the norm is just one long day. Mm. And so how you break that up can really help. So let's brainstorm really quick. What would it look like to make a delineation between your work week and your weekend while you're sheltering in place? What do you think?
I have no idea. I have like, you know, the thing is, this is an issue, again, personal stuff, but it's an issue that I've had even before the pandemic. So if I had an answer, I would have had it already. I guess not working, which I work less on weekends, of course. I'm not going to, you know, pretend I do the same work days. But the big irony is that I don't really have time to get out of the house, even though I could. And there's the forest right there. Most days I don't even get out. So maybe that could be a thing, trying to go out of the house and doing stuff outside. But I don't have a specific idea. And I guess I'm in the majority here, as you were saying. We don't even really know what we feel and how to deal with it. So I'm not sure. Just not working, I suppose.
Okay. Here's my thought on that is the not working, of course, is supposed to be the difference between a week and a weekend, right? But even if you still want to get a couple hours in, it might be to time block it. So if you have young children, there's a common thing, at least that goes around where I live, about, you know, to keep your sanity is you block out your time every day. So it would be an hour and a half or 3 hour blocks. You kind of pick how your toddler operates, right? But you have the first hour and a half block is preparing for the day. It's eating, it's getting dressed, it's all those things, maybe exercising. And then the next block is a work block, or the next block is a, you know, we're going to learn to paint, you know, depends on what, if this is for a kid or for yourself. And so you do this block by block, and each block has a point, right? I have some clients right now who are, you know, they're sheltering at home and they have two or three rooms that they have in their apartment or in their home, and they plan their day time blocking based on the room. So they work in this room. They do nothing else in that room but work. So the line is the door, and then bedrooms only for the bedroom things. And then the TV room is only, it's like designated weekend and relax time. Like it would be normally if you had to do your other job or whatever. It's like you artificially create, you're using, instead of the outside world, you use your inside world and have some lines and some consistency so that this room is for this reason and this time block is for this thing. So your day is pretty time blocked already. It would look more like your weekend that you start, let's say it's Friday night, you start with some kind of tradition, like we always watch our favorite blah, blah on Friday night and have popcorn. You add some element that makes it different from other nights where you're watching TV. Or Saturday morning, we take the kid on a deep dive into the forest and we're going to build a little fairy world with sticks and stuff. I don't know, something. I love Finland and Sweden, so I could just picture a fairy land. Anyway, but like you would have a reason that you were leaving and you would have a time frame where you would do it, just like real life used to be, right? There was a time frame and you had a reason. So you make one up and then you come home and maybe it's, or you make some special breakfast on Saturday or Sunday mornings. Mm. So there's something that breaks up why we do something and when we do something, and it has a time to do it and a reason to do it. And so as people are listening, they may be thinking, oh, I should do that. Here's how you do it. You sit down with paper and a pen and a calendar, and you just look at your days and start to block them in increments. So humans work best in hour and a half increments. So our sleep cycle is an hour and a half is one cycle of sleep. So typically at night, if you go to bed at 10, like you do, and wake up at 6, that in theory is great. If you take the kid out, you'd be well rested. But what it is that it's these hour and a half windows. That's why if you sometimes wake up at the wrong part of a sleep cycle, you feel like you're going to die, like you're dead to the world, because you have woken up in the wrong part of that hour and a half increment. And then wakeful hours, it's about a 90-minute block as well. We need to get up and move after 90 minutes. Typically, if we're in a sitting working situation, change of scenery every about 90 minutes, a snack, we have to go to the bathroom. So we're really built to focus and be on a task for about 90 minutes max. So maybe think in blocking in those terms, and take a piece of paper, write it down, block out your week, make sure your weekend looks different. You know, a lot of people have done this who have those shifts that like maybe they work all weekend, but they have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday off. Like, how did they do it? Well, they have to come up with their own artificial way to make it feel like a break in a weekend. Because what we know is humans have to recover. And none of us are actually recovering. We are just going and going and going. And we have to recover, even if it's not physical recovery, it's psychological recovery.
So if I'm understanding correctly, the simple act of doing something different on the weekend breaks you out of the monotony and helps you recuperate a little bit, even if you artificially create that different thing that you do.
Yes. And think about it for a minute. Weekends are artificial creations anyway. They always have been.
Rested on Sunday.
We're just making it up again, right? Okay. Another version of it.
Right. Yeah. No, okay. So even if you don't feel like there's something you necessarily want to do, like deciding, even let's say you want to do something, you want to paint a room, and you would do it like 1 hour every day of the week, it might be beneficial. I'm just making stuff up, but it might be beneficial to say, you know what, I'll leave it to Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and do a couple or 3 hours on those days rather than distributing it to make every day exactly the same.
Yes, absolutely. So creating a difference, even if it's a work thing, that could be different. Absolutely. I think the other piece too is going back to the Patrick lunches. This is the most important part of this, is that you absorb that break. Right, that you take it fully in, you're fully present, because that's a different mind state than when you're working or taking care of kids. We're mostly not present through most of our lives. We tend to be thinking about the thing we have to do, or regretting a thing we did or should have done. There's it's very difficult for us to be fully present in the moment. But we know from research and many, many, many meditators that those who can stay in the moment and have the capacity are just better off on every measure, because they can fully appreciate the life that they are currently living. And that's not an easy ask. And most of us have avoided the present moment with all sorts of busyness. And that's what this sort of is a reckoning, I think, for everyone, of like, you got to look at your family straight in the face a little bit. You got to look at yourself. You know, this is an honest moment of, where are things really at for me? Because I can't go to the bar to escape this, or I can't, you know, get all the accolades at work maybe in the same way that I used to. So a lot of the stuff is falling away, and we're sort of down to this core stuff. And to really nurture ourselves, we have to make sure we're taking care of ourselves, because this cortisol stress cycle thing, it will not, it doesn't end well. It never does. It always pushes us to a physical limit or a mental limit, and, you know, we can get in trouble. Mm.
So I guess I have a couple of questions there. The first one, which I'll ask you to answer second, is could you tell us what happens when those cortisol levels don't go back down? Because we're talking a little bit in theory there, but I'd love to know actually, you know, maybe it's going to be motivating to some people to hear what happens. And the second thing is, it's all well and good to say you have to be in the moment. That's something I struggle with very, very, very much. I'm always, my mind is thinking about three things at once, and I'm sure many people do, most people do probably, but for me, it's an actual condition. Like, I don't know if it's a medical one, but something that I really struggle with. I am never doing only one thing, and I'm always thinking about everything else I should be or want to be doing. So
I have a question. How can you do that? How do you do your lunches then? How have you figured that out?
That's a very good question. I guess I just focus on the TV show. Maybe that's why I love that moment so much.
Right. And you don't actually have to try very hard, right?
It
just sort of works. Right. Yeah. Okay. And so you just proved you have the capacity to do one thing. However, intentionally doing one thing is a different story, right? Because it means you have to quiet your mind enough And the TV show helps you do that, right? But if you just put you in silent, you know, silence somewhere and just said, okay, try to think about one thing.
So meditation, tricky. Kind of. I've tried a yeah. little bit of meditation.
It so kind of meditation, works. And here's the thing about mindfulness meditation. And mindfulness meditation is different from other types. There's obviously many different ways to go about this. But this is the one we have the most sort of research on and has been shown to be the most effective in short doses or short, you know, training versus some of the others require like a lot more practicing. In 10 minutes a day of mindfulness meditation, you will notice a significant difference. So for example, I started, Calm is my favorite app. There's plenty of them out there. I don't pay for apps. That tells you a lot about me. I like, forget it. Nothing is serving me here except Calm is the only app that I've ever paid for. And I love it because I don't have time. And I tested it out because I wanted to stop telling my clients to all do something I hadn't done. I was being a hypocrite. So I bought the app and I meditate every day for 10 minutes. And it's 10 and it stops at 10 minutes. It is not longer than that. And within about a week or two of doing this every day, I had multiple experiences that blew my mind. It was where I could focus on something. I didn't intentionally do it. I just was able to keep my mind completely on the thing I was doing. It just happened. It was awesome. And really what it is, and so that was my personal experience, but the research backs this up, which is think of it as like a gym for your brain. You're never going to get good at meditating. People always think, oh, I'm bad at it. Yeah, everyone's bad at it. It's because our minds are monkeys and they're going to jump around. But if we train our minds to come back to our breath, which is what mindfulness mainly is the breath is the one thing we can always come back to because it's the thing we always have to do. And so all you're doing is your mind wanders, you bring it back. Your mind wanders, you bring it back. You're just doing like push-ups with your brain. And even just 10 minutes a day makes a big difference. And so that is a really powerful, very simple way to train your brain. And lots of people benefit. A lot of people do way more than 10 minutes, but I don't. And I still feel like there's a lot of benefits from a small amount. In fact, my days just go way better. That's the other thing. If you start doing it in the morning, your difference in your days, it's weird. It's really helpful. So that is one thing is to train your brain to do this. And then the other is for others, they may just think they need permission to slow down or they need permission to not be the mom full time and the worker full time and, you know, to find space. Patrick time, sometimes they need permission. And right now, more than anything, people have to find a way to give themselves space to repair mentally. So every day, think about dreaming for a second. So we live our lives and then we dream at night. And when life is going pretty good, our dreams are kind of either boring or maybe enjoyable or not a big deal, right? What's interesting is right now there is worldwide studies going on about dreams that will be fascinating to hear about in the end because suddenly we have the whole world having a similar experience and we have these dream researchers that are already in place to do this work and what they're finding is because our lives are now so small, right? Normally what happens is I move throughout my day and I run into this person or I'm at that store. I have a lot of information that my brain uses to do process the dreams at night. So you'll dream about a thing you saw that day. But when you're only home, and it's the same walls and the same people and the same stuff. What people are finding, and this is worldwide, which is just so fascinating to me, is their dreams are getting, they're more vivid because there's more stress that's generally involved in our lives that comes out in dreams. That's how we process psychological distress in our sleep. And it more random, right? And it's taking stuff from our past because we don't currently have visual cues to work with. We have, you know, your girlfriend from eighth grade. You have your boss from when you were 22 and, you know, like, and then you're in a place you traveled once way back in the day and you're the mixing and the pulling from our history is just, it's really fascinating. And it's one way, and this is why sleep is connected is, depression. And so you ask the question, what does burnout ultimately look like? The cortisol continuously, what happens? Well, the burnout occurs in a couple ways. It affects our sleep dramatically. It'll affect our eating habits. We will feel, it's called anhedonia. We pleasure in the things we normally find pleasure in.
You cut off for a second. You were saying it's called?
Oh, it's called anhedonia. And hedonic pleasure is like, you know, good food and all that good stuff. And anhedonia means you don't feel that, you don't have the same desire or craving for those things that used to bring you joy. And those things lead, that it turns into sort of classic depression is what it looks like. And so maybe there's no depression that runs in your family. Maybe you've never struggled with it before, but you're starting to feel some of the numbing effects of having this cortisol too much in your system, or you're feeling less, you know, motivated to do certain things. Your sleep is worse. Your eating is worse. So I think this is collectively what a lot of us are going through. And so we have to really work hard to try to repair, take breaks, create structure and meaning. And then this final thing, and I'd love to hear how you do this, is to connect socially in different ways. So what do you do, Patrick? And maybe it's just already built into your work life. And
But
how are you connecting with people?
That's exactly what it is. I think my job is to an extent connecting with people that I don't meet physically. So I've always said, you know, half of my life is spent on the internet anyway, and that's not just, you know, reading Twitter, although that's also part of it, but half of my friends are on the internet and we interact together a lot already, and that was the case before the pandemic. So it's kind of, as you said, baked into my job. Because I still have half of that, even if I'm at home. So I'm very lucky in that way. But I guess
others
will have to.
You're well trained for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, and I just want to throw out this sort of crucial element to humanity's sort of well-being is social connection. So if you think of any big calamity that's happened anywhere, it could be an earthquake, or 9/11 is a great example of that, or, you know, some disaster or challenge that has occurred in a community. One of the most powerful ways that people overcome that is they come together, right? They are physically together. They are working. They're, you know, they're doing good. Their identity is that we're part of this, and we are part of a group. We are part of the helpers and, you know, all that good stuff. We have the exact opposite, where we have to be apart. So we have to artificially create some connectivity to get some of the benefits that we are built as humans to require. We require them. So you have yours kind of already set and ready to go. And maybe you reach out a little more, or even, you know, create a couple more opportunities already within the system you have established, which is awesome. Lots of people may not have any of this. And so they need to find ways to connect virtually that they're not used to. So one thing I've seen going around that I think can be really helpful and also make a weekend feel like a weekend is to gather friends for an online game that, you know, say you're not a gamer and you've never done that before, but you get on Zoom and you're all playing some kind of card game at the same time, or charades, or, you know, it doesn't have to be something you've always done. It can be, you know, brand new, but this way of just seeing their faces and laughing together, and it's different from the rest of your other days. So to find ways to build in connections, even a great one is to contact people that are from your former lives that you just haven't talked to in a long time, because they're all sitting at home too. You're never gonna really bug anyone. No one's too busy for this. I mean, kind of, but you know what I mean? They're, hey, remember college? And they're just like, yeah, I was thinking about you. It's been really fascinating. I've received so many emails from former clients. I kept thinking I would get emails where they would say, oh no, I'm dying. This is so hard. And what can I do? Instead, I'm getting thank you emails. Just thank you for working with me. Just taking a minute out of their time to remember I existed and I helped them once, and to thank me. And it has been so heartwarming and amazing. So I know, speaking as someone who has received that contact, how powerful that would be for you to reach out to someone in your life and thank them, or maybe say sorry, or, you know, find
so
some ways to do that.
Yeah, it's not just let's have, you know, Thursday night beer because, oh, it's fun. It's like it's actually important to see someone else's face to help again in that the physical, chemical things that happen to your body when you're in that monotonous routine.
Yes. And seeing someone's face specifically lights up parts of our brain that does not get lit in just audio or, you know, and it's not that that's not fun or that's okay, obviously, but there is more to seeing someone face to face than we fully can appreciate. And so the more you can do that, the better, more creative. I mean, there's so many ideas online. You just Google, how do I do some of this?
Right. Yeah, I think most people have thought about it, but that's why I was insisting on that part. It's not, you know, I'm sure many people have done it or have thought about it or have a way they could do it, but it's not just about having fun. It's like it's important to get through it to do these kinds of things. It's not medicinal, I guess, but almost in a way.
Right, absolutely. And then there's one final thing I want to, that I think is amazing, because I think it's happening maybe a little more naturally, but is also very, very well studied, which is finding things you're thankful for. So like just increasing your gratitude for stuff. So the research is on this is rock solid, which is three things a day you write down that you're grateful for every day. And they need to be small. It needs to be like running water, the forest outside my door, you know, and then the next day it's got to be something different. Like, you know, I'm grateful for that people are funny and put their content online or whatever. You just, you find a moment. And this is similar to the Patrick Lunch in the sense of you absorb and you sort of dive into this feeling of how grateful you are about something and something small. And what we found is your immune system's better. Your outlook on everything is better. Like it has a big impact on mood and feelings of well-being. So if you take nothing away from this hour conversation with Patrick, if you could do this and note the things you're grateful for every day, writing them, it matters. It's not simply, I mean, saying them out loud is helpful, but writing it down can also be, it's really important, kind of cements it and pay attention to that feeling. There are so many medical, physical benefits, psychological benefits, all these good things. And there's so many easy ones to find, right? I mean, I've thought about what, you know, gathering somewhere. Like, I'm so grateful that may one day be a thing and how much I took that for granted before, you know, or the technology that allows us to connect or work or do the things that, you know, even 20 years ago would be impossible. Et cetera.
Yeah, it's funny. I watched a video. I guess it's in the air. I don't know if you know the YouTube channel Kurzgesagt, which is very well done, like science vulgarization. Do you say that in English? Like popularizing of science. Anyway, they were talking about this and the importance of being thankful and how much better the lives of the people who feel thankful and. I think one of the reactions of people listening might be, well, of course, some people have stuff to be thankful for. And it's important, I think, to note that this is not what it's about. Everyone has stuff to be thankful for. And within every, I don't know, socioeconomic category, the ones who are thankful for the stuff they have, and it's not about, you know, not going after the things you have to go after. It's a very different thing. But the ones who are thankful for the stuff that they can be thankful for live better lives. Like it has, as you were saying, consequences on every part of your life. So that's really interesting that you're mentioning it too. It's so easy to get down the spiral of negativity, especially with 24 hours news cycles and like, I have things, bills to pay and I'm tired and I have this and that to do. And it kind of overtakes your life. And when in reality, there are many things that are like, I'm thankful for antiviral research and modern medicine and stuff like that.
Right. I am so thankful that the lady who is checking me out at the grocery store and just putting herself in that position every day, like, wow, you know? And here's the thing, you're absolutely right. I think I'm going to just share a little secret. I have had a number of clients in my years of working who are very wealthy, and you would look at them on the outside and just assume that they were so lucky to have all the things that they had. Oh, I've never met anyone more miserable, ever. And I wouldn't trade. And so I've often, you know, and some of the happiest people I've ever known had so little. And I just think, We have it backwards. We all think, I'd be different. I'd be grateful. I'd be happy if I had my yacht. But there, you know, really, really looking at what you have can change your whole day and say, you know, even if it's as simple as running water, or that plumbing was invented. I always think of that one, like, that's amazing. Or electricity, or, you know, you get really basic and you try this for a week and I promise your attitude will change. We have a bit of, what about, well, yeah, that's easy for you to say that. It's sort of a competitive scarcity thing that we have. But when you can take in your own life and see the abundance of good that's in your own life, it changes how you feel and see everything. It's, again, like I've kind of, the theme here is we train ourselves and we practice certain things and we get an outcome. So if I'm training myself in negativity and thinking everyone else is terrible and crucifying anyone who takes a misstep or, you know, whatever, then how I feel about me is harsh, right? If that's how I feel about everyone else. And so it's stopping, and you're home alone with yourself. And so it's this crazy moment in time where your relationship with yourself is suddenly really important and there's no way to hide from it. And, you know, so it's taking a hard look, and that's tricky, but this is one exercise, this gratitude thing every day, that really can help people. So I would leave that as my main things, everyone to try.
Excellent. And in, just in case someone is thinking about sending an email about, you know, some people don't have enough to eat. Obviously, we're talking like, if you have your basic needs taken care of, then it's easier to start thinking about what you're thankful for. If you're sleeping outside, I don't think, and maybe it would improve even for those people, but if you're homeless and you don't have enough food, obviously that's not the case where we're saying, oh, just think that you're thankful for, you know, I don't know, like the mattress you're sleeping on and everything will be fine. That's not what we're saying. So,
right. Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It was much more introspective than I thought it was going to be, but that's really interesting. And hopefully everyone listening will get at least one or two things, you know, to take away and help get through that difficult moment in our collective history. So thank you very much, Wendy, for all of it.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Where would people go if they want more of those amazing, that amazing wisdom you're dispensing?
That's nice. Well, a couple places. Therapy Thursdays with an S.com. You can email me through there and find some old content. I've been terrible at updating. Also, I have started a program that is really fun if anyone's ever interested. In fact, it's so fun to do it right now because, oh man, it's a weird time, called Real Steps. So it's realsteps.org, realsteps.org. And you can just sign up to get an email, or if you want to email me through there, at admin@realsteps.org. And I can tell you more about it. It's basically just very incremental, psychological and physical changes for health. I work with a nutritionist and we are building a pretty cool community there and figuring out how to improve our psychological and physical well-being just slowly, so it sticks, rather than, you know, lose all the weight and be amazing in 5 minutes, you know, it's the opposite of that. So you can find me in both those places. And then also you can just find me at my house sitting around.
But don't go there. Just if you do, just don't. Wave from the light street.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Very cool. Thank you very much, Wendy. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you want to see how the weather is insane in Finland in spring, it's like literally it was covered in snow this morning. It was raining. It was snowing. And now it feels like summer. Like this is... And I'm staying here working, so I'm not enjoying any of it. It's criminal. And if you want to support the show, you can do so on Patreon, patreon.com/thePhileas Club. Please consider doing so if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy what we do. And that's about it. We will be back with, I'm guessing, a regular episode, which will be about the virus, I suppose, again in a couple of weeks or so. So thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you then. Bye.